Thank you, everyone. This is the operator. Just need to inform all participants that today's conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. If you do need my assistance for today's call, please press star zero. Ma'am, you may begin.
Thanks very much. This is the August meeting of the Charm Telecon, and we have an interesting speaker today. It's Frank Postberg, and he's on the Cassini CDA team, and he's going to talk about Enceladus and some evidence in the CDA data for a subsurface ocean. And Frank suggests that you download the PowerPoint presentation as opposed to the PDF. Some of the nice graphics and things are not available in the PDF file. So go ahead and download the PowerPoint from the password protected website, and that'll make it a little more meaningful. We also need to remind you that star 6 mutes your phone. If you have any noise near you, you can do that without having a mute button on your phone. And he joined the team in 2004, and he's been working on analyzing the CDA data, and he brings an expertise in both physics and chemistry to bear on the data, and he's looking in particular at the composition of the Saturn dust environment. So he's going to talk to us today. Are there any questions from the participants before we get started? And maybe, Frank, if you want to pause every, you know, once in a while and ask for questions, that might be good. So with that, Frank, go ahead.
Okay. So, yeah, if questions arise, so feel free to interrupt me. That's not a problem. But I will stop, like, every 15 or 20 minutes. So I make, like, two breaks for questions in between. And then, of course, at the end, there's plenty of time. So I will say click if the slide is to be changed. Okay? So, this talk is about Enceladus. On the first slide, we see it as a small black dot embedded in millions and millions of tiny ice grains which form the E-ring. And just below the black spot, you can see very bright area, and this is the plumes where the ice and gas is driven out of the ice crust southward from the moon. And I'm going to report about a strong indication that those plumes are driven by evaporation from liquid water reservoirs, which are likely fed by a larger subsurface ocean on Enceladus. So click.
Okay. So we clicked already. So this just does the overlay on the first view graph, right?
Yeah, that's slide two now.
Okay.
On the upper right picture, you see the beautiful ring system of Saturn. And from Earth, actually, only the inner bright rings can be observed. And the outermost ring is the E-ring, which is where Enceladus has its orbit. Enceladus we see on the left picture, and it's not a very big moon. The diameter is about 500 kilometers, but it's a surprisingly active guy. So click. In the south polar area, you can see the fourth stripes, the so-called tiger stripes, and this is the active region where the plumes come out. The stripes itself are much hotter than the rest of the ice crust, about 100 Kelvin warmer than the ice, than the rest of the moon's surface. And within these tiger stripes, there are certain hot spots which are the sources of the plumes, which we see on the lower right picture, going several hundred kilometers outward. And now click. Now you see how how Enceladus is embedded in the outermost diffuse E-ring and on its way around Saturn. It constantly loses ice grains and by this means forming the beautiful ring. Click some basic parameters on Enceladus. As I said, the diameter is about 500 kilometers, but for such a tiny or small moon, it's surprisingly dense. The dense is about 1.6 times the density of water, and that means that there must be much more than ice. The core of Enceladus is most likely formed of rock, and only the outermost 60 to 70 kilometers are an ice layer with some water in between. So the surface temperature on the equator is only 18 Kelvin, and the South Pole Taiga tribes normally would expect it to be colder because it's a pole, but here it's different. It's 100 Kelvin or degrees Celsius warmer than at the equator. So the production rate of the plumes is about 200 kilos per second. Most of it is gas, and about 20 kilogram per second it's ice grains, ice dust. We call everything dust. If it's ice or rock, doesn't matter. Important is, so 90% of the production is in the form of gas, and only a small fraction is dust. And the escape speed, that is the speed which is necessary to escape the gravitation and escape into the ring, is depends a little bit on the starting point. It's between 230 and 300 meters per second. And the average gas speed, the speed with which the gas, the water vapor, is ejected from the sources in the crust is about 500 meters per second, and that is easily higher than the escape speed. So most of the gas escapes the moon's gravity into the Saturnian system. It's a bit different with the dust. The average dust launch speed is 150 meters per second only, and this is a bit below the escape speed. But, of course, not all dust grains have 150 meters per second. There's a distribution in launching velocities, and some are faster, especially the smaller ones, they are faster than the escape speed, and so some manage to escape and form the E-ring. But it's only 1 to 5% of the ice grains which are formed, which escape, and the rest falls back on the moon. And on the lower right you see a map which has been calculated in our group. It's by numerical modeling, lots of computer calculations based on the 8 known plume sources, which are the black dots. There the particles are launched, and then you can see where the ice grains fall back, and the thickness of the ice deposition is color-coded here. So some grains make it all the way up to the northern hemisphere, but by far most of the grains are deposited directly or close to where they started, so at the Taiga Stripe region. But when the different launching speed of gas and dust fraction, that is a very remarkable thing. So that tells us that the gas and the particle flow are decoupled immediately after launch, or probably before that. And that has some implications on the formation process, but I won't go into further detail now. So that are the basic parameters about the moon I'm talking about today. So next slide, and here again, we see the ring system. The lower picture shows it's a bit more extended. You see that besides Enceladus, other moons are embedded in the E-ring. as Tethys, Dione, and Rhea. And our measurements show that the E-ring is even goes even beyond Rhea's orbit. It's almost to Titan's orbit, extended to Titan's orbit. It's the largest known planetary ring by this means. And because this ring is so diffuse, it's no problem for Cassini to cross the ring without risk of damage or too much risk. And this is done regularly, and this is the high time for our instrument, because we can do in situ sampling of those grains, which are mostly originated in Enceladus plume. And by analyzing those grains, we can conclude on processes which happen in the formation of the grains below the surface of the moon. And because we do this orbit cross, the E-ring crossings quite regularly, and there's lots of detections during each crossing, we get an excellent statistics, which is much better than we get when we fly through the plumes. So we get a good picture of what different populations are there in the E-ring and are produced by Enceladus by probing the E-ring during the crossings. And the particle sizes I'm talking about is pretty small. It's 0.1 to 1.5 micrometers. Next slide. Now, why sodium is so important? If you form a planetary body like a moon, when the formation of the solar system, then all the sodium, or the salts where the sodium is in, is basically in rock. So if you have a rocky surface and you irradiate it or bombard it with something, then sodium is easily liberated, as can be seen in the case of Mercury or Earth's moon. But on a body with an icy surface, you normally don't expect much sodium or even any sodium. But if liquid water gets in contact with rock, then those sodium salts are dissolved in water. It's, in fact, the rock component which most easily dissolves in water. And by that means it's washed out and extracted and concentrated in the water fraction. So that's the same mechanism is at work on Earth. That's the reason why the oceans on Earth are actually salty. The salt has been washed out from the rocky crust of on Earth. And so this is the good thing, a good way to tell if there's liquid involved. If you would detect sodium in greater abundance on such a body. And the second thing is, the second important thing, why sodium is a litmus test for liquid water as a plume source, is that if you had a salt water reservoir like an ocean, and it would freeze, like would have been frozen like millions of years ago, then you have a phase separation. The sodium salts, they don't stay in the ice. The frozen salt water is, so to speak, it's basically salt-free if you freeze it slowly, like you would expect on a planetary surface with a slow downward freezing. So that's a good test if you have ice sublimation of warm ice as a plume source, or liquid water. If you have sublimation of ice, you don't expect sodium. And if you have liquid water involved, then sodium is expected. Next slide. So here we see the Cassini spacecraft and where the our instrument, the Cosmic Dust Analyzer, CDA. It's the spacecraft configuration, actually, before the drop of the Huygens probe. It's still mounted on the left side. The yellow heat shield can be seen. Next, and here on the right, you see a bigger picture of the detector. It's about 70 kilograms in weight, and the aperture is about close to half a meter. Now, I try to briefly explain how we get chemical information of a dust particle with our instrument, or an ice grain, whatever solid little thing hits our detector. So if it hits our detector, it hits very hard. The typical impact speeds are around, say, 10 kilometers per second, and by that means, of course, the ice grain is totally evaporated and destroyed and atomized. In fact, the impact is so hard that some of the atoms and molecules lose electrons and are ionized. So we have an impact cloud, which consists of some neutral molecules, but also positive and negative ions. And then there is a strong electric field, which does a charge separation, a strong electric field which works on the impact cloud. And the positive fraction of the impact cloud is accelerated towards the multiplier by the electric field. And the length of the travel, the duration of the travel until the ions reach are detected by the multiplier depends, of course, on the mass of the atomic ions or molecular ions. So the cationic fractions reach the multiplier separated by the masses, and by that means you get a nice time-of-flight mass spectrum if everything went well. The mass resolution is not as good as at Earth in the chemical laboratory, but here we are working in space and have samples which are very tiny and hit the detector very fast, so it works fine for our purposes. Next slide. And here we see an example of a sodium or salt-rich water ice grain as it was measured by the detector. It's about 6% of the E-ring particles, of the thousands of E-ring particles we've detected, are that rich in sodium, as we can see here. I explain it a little in detail later. But the sodium abundance which is recorded here is far above any label level of possible instrument contamination or anything else. It's without doubt very rich in sodium. And not only the sodium peak, NH+, which can be seen at the left side of the spectrum, but also all the other peaks have a sodium or a potassium compound. So the NaOH, Na+ clusters, the hydroxide clusters, they tell us that not only that the ice grain must be sodium rich, but also that it must stem from water with an alkaline pH value. So, but not to be mistaken here, although we see sodium everywhere in this spectrum, the ice grain is still 98% or so water. It's only a smaller fraction of salt, but still we call that sodium rich. So, and other peaks tell us signatures tell us which is the sodium-bearing compound in the, which salts are here. And it's basically sodium chloride and sodium bicarbonate. And they form very specific signatures and clusters by which they can be identified. And we see only positive ions. Our instrument is only sensitive for the cations, and that's the reason why we don't see, for example, any chlorine ions. Although the chlorine must be almost as abundant as the sodium, we don't see any Cl+. And the reason is that chlorine likes to form negative ions, and although they are there, they are not visible for our detector. But the chlorine reveals itself in forms of clusters, as you can see here, at about 80 atomic masses. It's NHCl, Na+, and by that means we can also identify the anionic component of the salt. And we also see a minor potassium peak here. So we have sodium chloride, bicarbonate, sodium bicarbonate, sodium carbonate, soda, and potassium salts. And those four are exactly the four most abundant compounds which have been predicted to be present in an Enceladus ocean. In 2007, there has been theoretical calculations and modeling which where primordial rock was exposed to water over a long time scale, and those four compounds were predicted to be most abundant. That was before we came up with our measurements or the conclusions. And so as we found out what we have here in the sodium-rich grains, what components, we were, of course, very excited because it is more than circumstance that we find exactly the four compounds and in exactly the right concentration, which I show in the next slide, because we tried to narrow down how much salt we have. We knew it's a lot. But to narrow it down further, we carried out laboratory experiments, which you see an example in the lower panel. It's a laboratory spectrum. It has a higher mass resolution. There, but this is one which reproduces the nine most abundant peaks, which we find at Saturn very well. And the peak pattern we see is extremely sensitive to the concentration, not only the peak amplitudes, but which peaks do occur at all. And only in the very narrow, we tried hundreds of different salt mixtures, and only in a very narrow concentration range we found the peaks we see in this sodium-rich type 3 spectra. And we found the best agreement, you see, with 0.1 to 0.2 mole per liter. Mole per liter is the unit here of NaCl, slightly less sodium bicarbonate. And we needed a pH value of 9 in the liquid solution to reproduce the sodium hydroxide cluster peaks. The sodium-potassium ratio, we inferred from our measurements about 100 to 200. And the predictions for an early Enceladus ocean are quite close to what we have found, with the exception of the sodium-potassium ratio, which is lower than with new measure. It's surprisingly close to an early Enceladus ocean. We have a little more of the salt components than was predicted, but it's absolutely not a disagreement. On the contrary, it's a very good agreement with what was predicted. So we think that we are actually directly sampling a liquid salt water reservoirs some kilometers or hundreds of meters below the ice crust, which are feeding the plumes. So next slide. Now, how we think the sodium-rich grains are formed. We think that they are aerosol-like droplets, like a spray which shock freezes in the cold environment and forms ice grains, and by the fast freezing of this aerosols, the salt content of the ocean water is preserved. And these grains are subject to quite violent drag upwards by the water vapor and the gas, which is streaming upwards very fast through the ice cracks and channels, and they are dragged upwards, and they are rapidly accelerated. But on the way up, they are subject to condensation of water vapor as an outer shell, more or less on the sodium-rich droplets. So we don't know how big this effect is, if it really matters or not. It's actually something which we are working on currently. But the salt contents we identify in the E-ring grains can only be a lower limit because of that, because we probably have some pure water ice frozen on top. So the concentration in salt concentration in the ocean is at least as high as we see it in the ice grains. That's what I want to say, basically. So next slide. How to create a spray of water droplets. To do that, turbulences are mandatory on Earth. It happens with wind. If you walk along an ocean and you have a slight breeze, you smell the salt. And this is actually aerosols. You don't smell salt in the vapor. You smell the aerosols, which are created by the wind and then dragged to your nose. And here, of course, in Enceladus we don't have winds, but we very likely have gas bubbles. The Cassini INMS instrument, which is analyzing the gas and vapor which is coming out of the plumes, they tell us that only 90% of the vapor is actually water vapor. 10% is volatile gases. And with that mixture, if you put that mixture, of course, in a liquid source, you have lots of stuff bubbling through the water surface. And by that means, that is our most likely explanation how to form the water droplets, which then freeze and form the salt-rich grains. So where does all the volatile gas come from? There are several possibilities. Of course, our analysis tells us that we have a soda ocean, soda with lots of bicarbonate or carbonated water, so to speak. And if you stir that kind of water a little or heat it or change the pressure, then you form bubbles by setting free CO2. It's like sizzling mineral water. It's the same effect. So there's lots of CO2 stored as dissolved salts in the saltwater reservoirs. And CO2 is by far the most abundant volatile compound identified by INMS. It's between 5 and 6%, which is a surprisingly large number. Then, of course, there can be gases stored in the solid water ice, the form of clathrates. And if this clathrated ice is melts or gets warmer, then the gases which have been stored are set free. So this is another possible source for the large non-water gases. I listed some examples which have been identified by Cassini INMS. And last but not least, we have a possibility of hydrothermal processes at a hypothetical warm liquid rock interface deep below the surface, where other gases could have been produced millions of years ago or billions of years ago or even currently. That's unclear. So that possible sources for gases which form the bubbles and from which the which is the reason why we can directly see frozen or why we think where we can receive directly frozen saltwater samples of the ocean. So next slide. Probably this is a good moment to make a short break, and if anyone has questions.
Does anybody have questions online? So I have a question about the laboratory setup. I don't know how any of this works. So you go into the laboratory, what do you have, like a glass of water, and you kind of vary the pH and all the chemistry until you come up with a spectra that looks like the one you see with CDA. Could you kind of describe how that works?
Yeah, it's we start with a glass of water, actually. Yeah, a small glass. Where we tried hundreds of different glasses, different mixtures and pHs, but from that water we form very tiny micron-sized water droplets, and those droplets are accelerated and subject to time-of-flight mass spectroscopy. Oh. So by this means we try to simulate the CDA ionization process, and that method works quite well. So we form tiny water droplets which have about the same size as the E-ring grains, and it's a bit more complicated, but
yeah.
I think it would go too far if I go into further detail.
So then you accelerate them towards a detector like CDA?
No, it's not. It's a different detector. It has a better mass resolution. It's a laboratory instrument, and with a better mass resolution, we were actually able to get a better interpretation of the CDA spectra, which have a pretty low mass resolution.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, it doesn't matter if the droplets are liquid, like in the lab, or frozen, like at Saturn, because with the impact energies, anything gets evaporated fastly anyway, and the state of aggregate is not important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Thanks, Frank. Go ahead.
Okay. Then the next slide, the sodium poor water ice. So far, I have only been talking about the sodium-rich population, which is only 6% or so here, but most of the E-ring grains are sodium poor. And here we see in the spectrum pure water clusters, which they have a dot on top of each peak. It's pure H2O clusters. And but there's also some sodium with the triangulum. The triangulums that are clusters of sodium with water molecules. But it's very, very few. So the sodium to water ratio is 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the minus 5. That's what we inferred from the measurements. The laboratory experiment told us that it's probably even less. So, and also here in the sodium poor water ice, we see, besides sodium, we see some potassium as a minor compound. Next slide. So that's the bulk population. And now, how are the sodium poor grains formed? Naturally, if you have a salt reservoir and you evaporate it, that's what we think is happening at Enceladus and is driving the plumes, then the vapor is almost salt-free. You can calculate that, how much salt makes it from the salt water into the vapor. And the crucial factor here is the solvation energy, and it's negative. and you get very, very few sodium chloride out of the water. So if you see on the left the diagram, most of the sodium chloride is dissolved in NH plus and Cl minus, and the solvation energy of these ions is way too high to get any out of the water. But in the solution, you have always a few percent not dissociated sodium chloride in the water. And here the solvation energy is not that high, so there's a small loophole where some sodium chloride can traverse from the liquid phase to the gas phase. And we estimated and calculated that, and we come up with a number which is in very good agreement with what we see in the sodium per grain. So next slide. So how do they form out of the vapor? If you imagine that the water vapor is driven upwards, the vents very fast, then it's unavoidable that you have certain points where it's supersaturated, especially at nozzles where it is compressed. And then you have immediately formation of ice grains under the conditions. Abundant formation of ice grains, actually. This process has been modeled by our colleague Jürgen Schmidt in a Nature paper in early 2008. And with this process, he could reproduce the Cassini observations quite well. And so we think that is the process how most of the grains are formed. Water is evaporated with very few sodium in it, and out of that vapor, as it is dragged upwards in the vents, some of it condenses to the ice grains. And then this process creates more grains than actually this droplet thing, the aerosols which form the sodium-rich grains. Next slide. So why has sodium not been detected by other instruments? That has been quite an effort from the Keck telescope in Hawaii to identify sodium in the plume vapor, but the concentration of sodium in the plume vapor is very low, as I just explained. Above a salty liquid, you expect very few sodium. And if you don't have violent boiling, if you have more evaporation of the salt water deeper underground, then you don't get much sodium in the vapor. And so the sodium to water ratio we infer from our measurements is below the detection limit. So this is an agreement with non-detection by the Keck telescope under the lead of Nick Schneider. Then the second opportunity, so to speak, to detect the sodium is in the earring itself, because the grains are subject to sputtering in the plasma environment. And over the lifetime of the grain, as it is in orbit for years and years, it gets the sodium which is in it gets released. That's unavoidable. But you have to keep in mind that only 6% of the grains are sodium rich. So, but that is not the main factor here. The main factor is, as I said in the beginning, most of the grains fall back. In contrast, almost all of the gas gets out into the E-ring. And then you have 10 times more gas produced in the first place, and by that you get another dilution factor of about 400. And that, again, in total, gets you in the region, the mixing ratio of 10 to the minus 7, which is below the detection limit of the earthbound spectroscopy. Actually, you get the highest sodium concentration at the Tiger Stripes, because most of the grains fall back, and there they lie in the Tiger Stripe region, not diluted by the gas, or not very much diluted by the water vapor. And there you expect a ratio of 10 to the minus 4. That's the average. If you mix sodium-poor and sodium-rich grains, the ratio is about 10 to the minus 4. And maybe in future times the salt can be detected at the surface of the Tiger Stripes. But still, it's only 0.01%. It's not very abundant. So it's really, the salt is concentrated in this 6% of salt-rich grains, which are the frozen aerosols. Next slide. So how does the liquid reservoir look like? There are some constraints by which we can give an estimate how everything looks like. We know that the evaporation rate is about 200 kilograms per second. And if you evaporate something, it cools the water surface. That's what you feel on your skin when you evaporate your sweat, for example. And 200 kilograms per second is a lot. And the cooling effect is the greater, the smaller the surface area is. So if you look on the lower right model, if you would have a surface area which is as large as what we think is the outlets of the vent, the radii of an outlet of a vent is, or the channel width is about 1 meter, not more, probably less even. And if you would consider such a small evaporation process and evaporate 200 kilograms per second, you would have an immediately freezing due to the latent heat loss. So that is not an option. We observe, Cassini has observed the plumes for several years now, and there seems to be no dramatic changes, no sudden outbreaks of new sources and seizing of others. So So we need a larger surface of evaporation. So the left drawing probably is close to what is happening there, that the channels widen up to chambers, or at least to a larger water surface, which allows the evaporation of 200 kilograms per second without a subsequent freezing. The exact area or minimum area which is needed to produce the observed vapor is quite a wide span, as you see in the numbers here. The exact surface area depends very much on how effectively heat can be resupplied to the surface. Like, if you consider that there is convection, then of course warmer water can stream upwards if you have a cooling at the surface, and that's what would be very efficient way of cooling. Then you don't need a very large surface. Then you would be fine with only a square kilometer. And the other extreme is that you have no convection at all, that all the heat must be resupplied by what's the English word? By conduction, right? Conduction, not convection.
Yeah.
And that is much less effective. But this is quite an unrealistic case. And in this case, you would end up with 10,000 square kilometers. But the truth is probably closer to the lower number. But it's totally speculative. Next slide. Now, here you see five different models which have been discussed in the past. I will go through them from left to right. A is the so-called the cold faithful model, the Yellowstone-like model, where you have a violent boiling at the triple point, close to the surface, only a few meters under the surface. And this has been proposed very early in the discussion. But this process would be self-limiting. It couldn't maintain the observed steady jets over with have a similar outflow over years. And even more important, it would expel sodium with a liquid. Then you would have abundant sodium even in the vapor, and the Keck telescope would have seen a bright sodium shine, sodium streams coming out of the south polar region of Enceladus, and this is not the case. And, yeah, if it would need another argument, of course you would create only sodium-rich grains, or almost only sodium-rich grains with that geyser-type mechanism. So this is can be ruled out. So B, if we go a little deeper, if we just put the water surface a little deeper, that we have a bit of a back pressure in the channel and we don't have the violent boiling. But this, as I just said, the previous slide, is not an option because you have the heat flow problems. The vents would rapidly clog due to freezing. Then option C, well, in principle, our detection of sodium salts on a percent level and the ice grains rule out any ice sublimation model in the first place. But, of course, you can say, hey, why not entrain the salts after ice sublimation? And this is model C here. If you have ice sublimation and then the sublimated vapor crosses a shelf or a salty ice layer or a salt layer, probably from a frozen ancient ocean, and by that means the salt is entrained in the stream and the ice freezes around the grains. This is not very plausible for several reasons. The first reason, which I didn't even note down here, is that the spectra we get with CDA are not to reproduce with a salt grain which is covered with ice. We only get the spectral signatures we see if we have really frozen salt water. So that would make this difficult. Moreover, this would be also a self-limiting process because the salt near the crack would be soon exhausted, and then you cannot resupply salt over longer time scales. And, of course, this is geophysically a bit strange to invoke such a geophysical structure here. Then option D is to say, okay, we have water, but it's actually not salt water. It has not been in contact with the rocky core. It's just meltwater. And the way you would produce a salt enrichment of meltwater would be that, of course, with the evaporation of water, you get a concentration in the liquid, because you evaporate water and the salt stays behind, or most of the salt stays behind. Then you have a concentration at least in the upper layer where the evaporation takes place, but the diffusion would rapidly smooth the salinity gradient, and we calculate that it's impossible to get such an enrichment by that effect, such a salt enrichment by that effect. So that leaves us with E, the pressurized saltwater chamber. That's the model we propose and which we think is in agreement with all the observations. So click. So I rated the models A, B, C, and D between impossible and not plausible. And I think E is, there are several good reasons to believe that we have cracks which open up to vapor chambers. There's a large liquid-gas interface. There you have a gas flow which back pressures. And you form the supersaturated gas, by which means you can easily produce the sodium poor grains. And the sodium rich grains are produced from aerosols above the liquid. It's in good agreement with the predictions for the ocean composition, and it's consistent with the observations. And among those observations, of course, is the non-detection by the Keck telescopes of sodium. So we have two more slides. The next slide shows some impressions from Earth, how glaciers and caverns of ice with water may look like. We have absolutely no idea how it looks like at Enceladus. It's just to give a first impression. If the one has to keep in mind that Enceladus has a very low gravity. It's slightly above 1% of Earth's gravity, so you probably can build very exotic pillar or arch structures which are stable, which wouldn't be stable on Earth, but which are stable in Enceladus. But to imagine a large cavern without any pillars, I think it's not likely. I think it's a more complicated structure than just a large cavern or several large caverns. But that's, again, pure speculation. So then we have the last slide, next, and now the global picture. Is the plume reservoir the ocean, or is it connected to the ocean? Here we have a drawing which has been published in the end of 2008 in Scientific American from Carolyn Poco. And the drawing gives a good overview, but of course it's just one idea, and it has several good things in it, but it has several things in it which are probably not true. But it's a good visualization, I think. So we have some indications. We have salt ice grains. This tells us that the reservoir is, or at least has been, in enduring contact with rock, probably with the rocky core. That is an indication that there is a link between the plume sources and rock, and an ocean as rock, in contact with the rock. So the second constraint is the geophysical stability. Stable cracks cannot go deeper than a few kilometers. So you cannot make cracks right down to the core. That's impossible. The maximum depth, that is what the experts tell us, cannot be deeper than a few kilometers at the most. And that, of course, is then the maximum depth of the water surface. So the surface, the evaporation, takes place somewhere between like 100 meters and few kilometers. So that these three principal archetypes of models. First would be a large deep ocean. You have only a thin crust, and underneath you have a 60 kilometer deep water ocean right down to the core. That cannot be ruled out at the moment, but of course is unlikely because of the heat supply. I mean, we know that there's a lot of heat produced and that it's warm at the South Pole, but such a large water reservoir, well, but might be. The other extreme would be option B, that You just have small isolated saltwater pockets which have been in contact with the rocky core once, where the salt has been extracted, but for some reason they have been cut off and now are on their own, and big kilometers of salt, of ice, are between those pockets and the rock and whatever there is. So, but at least those pockets cannot be very small. The volume must be greater than one cubic kilometer. That constraint comes from the observation of the E-ring. To create the E-ring and the extent of the E-ring to Titan's orbit as we see it now, one can model how long does that take, and that takes at least several hundred years, so the plumes must be at work for that, for a similar period, several decades or centuries, and to create that you need a reservoir of greater than one square kilometer, cubic kilometer. So, and the third option is something, anything in between. You have a shallow ocean, well, shallow in water depth, but deep under the ice crust, in contact with the rocky core, which in some way or the other resupplies the plumes. And this is probably the idea of the figure. But there are two things which cannot be. There are no geysers. I put there jets, which I think is a better word, because geyser imply a periodic activity, which is not the case and not in agreement with the observations. And, yeah, no water surface in narrow ice channels, so there must be some chambers which are missing here in the picture. Okay, so that was the global picture. Now, summary one, it's our direct findings and the measurements. There are 6% of E-ring particles which are particularly rich in sodium. The main sodium-bearing compounds are sodium chloride and sodium bicarbonate or carbonate. Potassium salts are also detected, and the total salinity is between 0.5 and 2%, and this is a lower limit for the concentration of the liquid reservoir. This is not consistent with the class rate decomposition model and not consistent with ice sublimation, but as I said several times, in very good agreement with liquid water in contact with rocky core. And I'm not saying that there is no ice sublimation and no class rate decomposition. On the contrary, there certainly is ice sublimation, and class rate decomposition would also be very plausible, but these mechanisms do not seem to be the important plume driver. The plume driver seems to be evaporation of liquid water. Then we have sodium poor population, which forms the bulk of the E-ring ice particles. Sodium concentration very low, and this, the concentration we find in those sodium poor grains, is in good agreement with vapor above a salty liquid. Then summary two, these two very distinct populations with distinct salt concentrations, very different salt concentrations, make two formation processes likely. One for the sodium-rich population is a direct freeze-out of submicron ocean water droplets, and the sodium-rich population comes from nucleation of salt-depleted water vapor, as has been modeled by Jungschmidt last year. And the results are in agreement with the non-detection by spectroscopy. Nick Schneider happily agrees to that. And the evaporation from liquid requires large surfaces. So that rules out violent boiling from near-surface geysers. More likely is evaporation into vapor chambers, which narrow down to cracks. And is there a connection to a large ocean? There are the three general possibilities I just pointed out. There still is the possibility that there is a large, very deep ocean under thin ice, which goes right down to the rock core. The other extreme would be small isolated saltwater pockets, which are cut off. And The third option is that the ocean at the rock supplies the plume reservoirs through a ductile ice layer. How this works is currently under debate and under investigation, but at the moment I would say that's the most plausible scenario, but that could change any time. So, and here I want to end. Thank you.
That's great, Frank. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for Frank out there? So I have a question. So in the extended mission of Cassini, we have some South Polar passes. Is there anything that we're going to do with the instrument, any additional measurements that would bring any more information to bear on this topic? Or, like, are we going to use different instrument settings? Is there any additional information that we need?
Yeah, we still want to get, of course, data from freshly ejected grains. I mean, we have had crossings through the plumes, and we have some data which is currently evaluated. I did it today, actually, again, but this is very complicated because the spectra look different, and there are several instrument effects. If you are in such a dense environment, dense in terms of particle densities and gas pressure. But for that, therefore, we are happy to have additional measurements with different instruments set up, and by that means we can constrain the chemical implications better, and that will happen just this year in November, and also in the extended mission. There are several more South Polar passes, as you pointed out.
Okay.
One question?
Sure, go ahead.
This is Matthew Oto with the Saturn Observation Campaign. Just a general question about possibilities of astrobiology in these geyser systems on Enceladus. I've seen a lot of popular press speculations on this, and what I would like to know is the possibilities of percentage-wise, or in other words, is the possibility of astrobiology in Enceladus just as good as the possibility of astrobiology being found in, say, the moon of Jupiter, Europa, which is known to have a subsurface ocean?
Yeah, well, that's a very hard question because we don't know very precisely what it takes to produce life. But, well, what we know, it takes at least three prerequisites. One is liquid water. The other is a heat source. And the third one is some ingredients, chemical ingredients to start organic chemistry and create larger organic molecules. And all these three things are present at Enceladus. So, but that doesn't mean that there necessarily is something happening, because we don't know how likely it is, even if you have these three things, to produce even a microbe. I don't know, but of course, Enceladus is still in the race, so to speak. There's nothing which rules out the formation of some astrobiologic precursors or whatever. And the only other body which I would rate at the same likelihood for complex organic chemistry is Europa. Yeah, because there you have also water, heat, and probably the chemical ingredients.
All right. Thank you very much.
Hello, this is Ron Hobbs. I'm a solar system ambassador at the Museum of Flight here in Seattle.
Great, go ahead.
Okay, I have a couple of questions that relate to slide 16. You talk about the evaporation of 200 kilograms per second of water That's to feed all the plumes, correct?
That's all together, yeah.
Okay. And if I understand correctly, that evaporation surface you feel has to be somehow within a couple of kilometers of the surface?
Yes, a couple of square kilometers at least. I mean, you mean below the surface?
Yeah,
oh, sorry.
It can't be really deep, right? Because the pressure would close off the vents.
Yeah, if you have tectonic activity there, and you cannot maintain these cracks stable over several tens of kilometers.
Okay.
Then they would, yeah.
So
then
in other words, the evaporation surface has to be fairly close to the surface of water has to be within, say, a couple of kilometers of the surface.
Yeah. That's true.
Thank you.
But it cannot be like only 20 meters below the surface, because then you would have violent boiling because you have direct exposure to the vacuum, and that's not in agreement with the observation. So it's somewhere between, say, 100 meters and a few kilometers.
Okay, that's good. Is there any estimate of the size of these vents, like
yeah,
the diameter of them?
Yeah, it can be inferred by modeling. I mean, the Cassini cameras resolution goes down to about 10 meters, and nothing can be seen. So it's certainly smaller than that. And the modeling of the vents, how they look like, and how the grains are produced, this comes up with about a meter of the diameter of the outlet of the vents. And probably this is also the size of the cracks, the diameter of the cracks.
Great, thank you.
Are there any other questions for Frank? Okay, that sounds like it's about it. Thank you very much, Frank. It was really interesting and provocative presentation, so we really enjoyed it. So next month we have Mark Showalter. He's one of our ring scientists, and he's going to show us some recent results from the Equinox portion of the Cassini mission. So that'll be really good, the last week of the month in September. So with that, I'll say goodbye to everybody and talk to you next month. Bye, and thanks again, Frank.
Bye, Masha. My pleasure.
Bye-bye.